Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. Today we have a returning guest, Mary Beth. Hello.
Hello.
Exciting to have you back. I don't know if you want to go over another quick overview about yourself.
Well, I'm a longtime fan of classic film. Currently, my big things I'm working on are my band, yeah. Which you got to see last
year. Yeah,
that
was great.
We're writing some new music currently, and I'm preparing for the Cleveland Marathon.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, wow. I'll give you credit for those marathons. I mean, that's not something I'd want to do, but bless you for being able to do that. And also, you're a very excellent singer. I was very impressed with your singing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
that's so nice.
Yeah. We're going to get in our time machine, and we are going back to 1942, and we are going to talk about...
I Married a Witch.
So this film was nominated for one Academy Award, Best Score, which I think very appropriate for this particular... I really like the score in this.
The part of the score, actually, that stands out the most to me, I don't know if it's original, but... in the wedding scene where the girl keeps
singing,
getting queued up to sing I Love You Truly.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite parts.
I think that might be an original song. Okay. I don't know that we can credit the score, but I'm going to talk a little bit about the score as we go on. Let's start at the beginning. Based on a novel by Thorne Smith called The Passionate Witch, Thorne Smith was known for his Topper novels, which were popular in the 1920s. There's also a film adaptation of Topper starring Cary Grant. I think there are several Topper movies as well. Unfortunately, Thorne Smith died of a heart attack at age 42, and he had not finished The Passionate Witch when he died. It was about 3/4 of the way finished. It was completed by his friend Norman Mattson, and it wound up becoming a bestseller, which then makes me wonder who got the proceeds.
Probably the one who completed the book.
Yeah. What about the heirs, the wife and the wife and the two daughters? Yeah.
Plus the estate.
I imagine it had to have been somewhat split, but I guess something we will never know. Screenplay by Robert Peroche and Mark Connelly. Robert Peroche is a 2-time Oscar nominee and won an Oscar for the film Battleground. Battleground was created from his own experiences in World War II, where he served as an infantryman in the famous Battle of the Bulge. He was actually in that battle. He is known for A Day at the Races and supposedly writing some of Groucho Marx's best lines, and he also became a lifelong friend of Groucho Marx. Mark Connelly was Oscar nominated for Best Screenplay for Captain Courageous. He was born in McKeesport, PA.
Ooh, some Pittsburgh connections.
Yeah. He was a reporter on the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, actually. And he was a Pulitzer Prize winner for his play The Green Pastures. And he collaborated for 4 years with a famous playwright, George Kaufman. We've spoken about him before. Mm-hmm. He did the screenplay, I believe, on Stage Door, or he did the play, I can't remember which. Who is also from Pittsburgh, George Kaufman. And our friend Mark Connelly, he lived to be 90 years old. Must be that good Pittsburgh
air. Yeah. Very good smog that he was breathing in.
The good Pittsburgh air, that's what got him that. But originally, the thing about this film, originally Dalton Trumbo was brought on to write the screenplay. However, he was having issues with the original producer, Preston Sturges, and Peroche was called in to help him out, and then Trumbo would eventually quit the film and it's not even credited in the screenplay. But director René Clair. So this is a French director. He was an ambulance driver in World War I as a young man. He would become a journalist and also do some film acting before turning to director. He was a tour director, writing his own scripts, directing, being very involved in every process of production. He was actually touted as one of the greatest French directors of the silent era. It is said that Chaplin was a great admirer of René Clair and maybe even perhaps copied some of his work in modern times. He copied it enough to be sued for plagiarism by Clair's production company. He only did a handful of films in the U.S. before returning to France, and he would eventually return to writing in his later years, publishing novels and articles. René Clair was also the producer on this film. The original producer was Preston Sturges, as we said, but there were creative differences between Preston Sturges and René, which caused Preston to leave the film and ask not to be credited. Drama.
There's always drama.
Yeah, especially in this particular one. Dalton Trumbo argues with Preston Sturges and he leaves, and then Preston Sturges argues with the director and he leaves. Nobody's happy in this production.
I know that René Clair also had some hesitations about Veronica Lake being cast as well. She really had to prove herself, which she did.
Yeah. And in his early French films, he was kind of very surrealist kind of filmmaker. So this is, to me, a huge departure from that. This is not surrealist at all. This is very cut and dry to me, almost cookie cutter 1940 type of film.
A very simple film. Yeah.
Yeah. Cinematographer Ted Tetz Laff. Jeez. He was nominated for one Oscar, Talk of the Town. His father was a race car driver and a movie stuntman. He usually did car stunts. He served in World War II as a major in the Army. He was a favorite of Carol Lombard. He worked with her in 10 films. He worked over 100 films throughout his career. He's known for such films as Notorious, The More the Merrier, which is one of my all-time most beloved films, The More the Merrier, and My Man Godfrey. There's some screwball comedies in there. And he lived to be 91 years old.
Another one.
Yeah. I'm telling you, these people, every time we do these podcasts, it's like the crew members seem to live to be forever and the actors die really early. It's like, what were the crew members doing? Well, you know, the actors, they get themselves in trouble. Mm. Our editor is Ida Warren. She started out as a secretary, then worked her way into editing. She was kind of a Paramount contract editor. She's known for His Kind of Woman and The Young Savages. Sadly, I don't have much else about her, although it's nice. Again, this is the second time in a row we've had a woman as an editor, so I love that.
Yeah.
Now, our most important guy, the score by Roy Webb. Roy Webb is our Oscar nominee here. He is a 7-time Oscar nominee, but he has never won an Academy Award, sadly.
Oh, yeah. The Diane Warren of that era.
Didn't even get a darn honorary like most people do. If you get 7 Oscar nominations, you're usually guaranteed an honorary, but he didn't even get that, poor guy. He started out on Broadway and he would go to Hollywood in his mid-20s. He would meet Max Steiner and would become a collaborator and longtime friend. Max Steiner is a very famous score writer. He's known for such scores as Gone with the Wind. And Max would eventually bring him to RKO, where he was the head of the music department. When Steiner wound up leaving RKO, Roy Webb was made head of the music department, and he was the head from about 1935 to 1955. He is known for his sinister scores in horror and film noirs, which, if you really listen to the score, I can hear bits and pieces of that in this. And his famous films include Notorious again, Out of the Past, Marty, The Enchanted Cottage, and Cat People.
Ooh,
I was wondering if you might get a
reaction.
I was wondering if I might get a reaction on that one. I thought to myself, I bet Mary Beth will be excited about that. And he lived to be 94.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so. And my last note about the crew is that the costumes are by Edith Head.
Of course.
Yes.
I did see that.
Of course. Okay. So, do you have any notes on the crew, or did you want to get started into the
I mostly had notes about the cast.
Yep.
So as far as Pittsburgh connections, since we had mentioned some earlier, Susan Hayward, who played Estelle, the shrew that Wooly was supposed to marry. Her late husband was acquaintances with a priest in Pittsburgh. So while she was a starlet, she mostly followed astrology, but she did later in life get baptized at the SS Peter and Paul's Catholic Church in East Liberty.
What was the priest?
I didn't write it down, but I did
the
write,
unnamed priest.
Yeah, the anonymous priest.
The anonymous priest.
And the other Pittsburgh connection I had, Veronica Lake's second husband, Andre DeToth, the director,
yeah,
who loved to spend her money.
Yeah, and steer her away from good projects.
Yes, did buy a plane in which she decided, while he was off on some business trip, rather, she decided she wanted to fly to New York with her assistant, Marge. And one of the stops along the way to refuel was Pittsburgh. Yeah. And because of the famous smog that we mentioned earlier in low clouds, she did get a little bit lost. The plane did get a little bit damaged. So while she stopped to refuel, it also had to be repaired. And a rare tornado touched down at that time.
That is rare.
I know. We don't get too many.
No,
here.
That's unusual. Well, I gather she managed to make it back out.
She made it to New York, but she hired a pilot to drive back, and they drove the rest of the way to LA.
She's like, I'm not messing around with this Pittsburgh weather. You know what? They did say she was an aviator. Mm-hmm. She was a good aviator, Veronica Lake. I have a lot of notes on the cast that I'm going to get to as we go through the plot bit by bit. A couple notes before that I have. Sol Sachs, he's the creator of Bewitched, stated in an interview for Bewitched that he drew inspiration both from this film and from Bell, Book, and Candle, which is a 1958 film, in creating the iconic TV series Bewitched. And another thing I found interesting is this film was made by Paramount Pictures, but if you watch the film, you see it says done by United Artists. And I was very confused about that at first. But apparently what happened is that Paramount Pictures was making all these productions and they had so many to release, and United Artists had so few that Paramount just gave some of their, well, I think they sold. I don't think gave. I think they sold some of their film to United Artists so they could release it under their banner, so that they could get films released. That's my understanding.
I mean, it makes sense that Paramount initially did it, because back in those days, it's not like today when an actor or actress works for whatever.
Yeah, freelances.
Yeah, so they had a
contract.
Veronica Lake had a contract with Paramount, as did Marge. It definitely makes sense. But
yeah, as we said, even the editor was a contract editor for Paramount. So yeah, when I saw United Artists, I was like, huh? So that
Mary
explains
Pickford
that. Okay, but on to the film. So even you get the score right off the bat, to be honest, because even in the credits, you have this sort of, I call it swirly music. I'm not really sure how else to explain it. This sort of swirly, jaunty music that I think goes really well with the witch thing. I will say, throughout this film, all the times I noted the music and the score, it just seems like what he was doing with the music was going really, really well with the action on the screen. And I thought that was really great. And I do think that's why he was nominated, because he did a really good job of that, in my opinion. So in the very beginning, there's this written message that says, long, long ago, when people still believed in witches. And then you get this flashback. First of all, I will say, this is clearly not anything on location.
Yeah.
These all look like sets that are not especially greatly constructed, a lot of them.
And you're already immediately dropped into the tone of comedy when a pilgrim is selling popped maize instead of popcorn.
Yes, that you get that right off the bat. But it starts out with, you see this pyre, I guess, this wood that's burning, they're going to have a burning at the stake, you know, is what you gather. And you have these Puritans. This is supposed to be colonial Salem, right? And there's a fellow passing sentence. He's got a scroll, you know, like it's very colonial times. And then he says, well, there will be a short intermission. And that's when they start, this vendor goes around and starts selling the popped maize, which I guess they called corn maize back then. So it makes sense. And then you see Frederick March and his sort of Puritan wig.
He's almost unrecognizable in that wig.
The one thing about Frederick March, and I'll talk about him for a second. Frederick March, a 5-time Oscar nominee. He won Best Actor twice for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and for The Best Years of Our Lives, which we just saw recently.
Yeah, I love that one.
A great film. When he was in school, I think this is interesting, because when he was in school, he would get involved in oratory competitions, and he was quite good. He'd actually go to different states and so forth and pursue these competitions, and he would also often medal or win. He was so good, there was a local article about him. And you can kind of see how You can get that from him. You can imagine him being a great orator. And then he served in the Army in World War I. He was begin his career as a banker, but after having an operation on his appendix, would begin looking for theater work. He was a superior stage actor and was an excellent mimicker, giving him the ability to change his persona to fit different characters. His breakout role was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it came with a price. The makeup was so extreme that he was almost permanently disfigured, and he had to spend 3 weeks in the hospital afterwards to recover.
Oh my goodness. That's not unlike the original Tin Man makeup. Yep. Was really dangerous.
It was really hazardous. Both those films are in the 30s, and they just schlop anything on them.
They weren't thinking about how it absorbed into the skin.
Exactly, or what it was made of. But he was graylisted for several years in film when he was accused of being a communist with the communist witch hunts. He is known for Inherit the Wind, 7 Days in May, and A Star is Born, the first A Star is Born.
First of many.
Is it the first? Yeah, the first. Is there not one before, too? I'm not sure.
All I know is there's about four or five.
Yeah, it's not the one with Judy Garland. So it's the one prior to that. So when you say he disappears into characters so much, you can sometimes not even recognize Frederick March. That's one of his great talents. So he's this Puritan guy, and he's telling this lady, this fellow's name is Jonathan Woolley.
Yes.
He was the one that ratted out these people, this witch in Warlock, who we find out to be named Jennifer and her father Daniel. And apparently he's telling this lady, this mother, about how Jennifer came and cursed him and said that all of his descendants would marry the wrong woman. And then right off the bat, this lady comes over and it's going to be his wife or whatever.
Prudence, I believe.
Yeah, I couldn't remember her name.
Purity or something like that.
It is Purity or something, yeah. And so she comes over and immediately she starts being kind of nasty. So that's, you're getting the beginning. All and these women are going to be these naggy type women.
And it's clear, too, that he wasn't 100% innocent in the barn with
no,
the
I know.
Witch.
It is, the way he's talking does.
A little bit of a romantic entanglement there.
Yeah, something like, oh, her blonde hair. And it does sound very suspicious. And then it's going to go through a bunch of, I guess they're not really flashbacks. I guess they're flash forwards, technically, where they're going to show you the date. It's going to have a card with the date on. And every time the card comes up, there's this trumpet fanfare from the score, which I think is really interesting as well. And it's going to be Frederick March in these various years. And this is, again, where he changes. He sounds different.
Shrews through the ages. Now, the one where he looks really old, I think, is
The
19th century. Was that actually him?
Yes, they're all him.
Oh my goodness.
That's why I'm saying he's really good at disguising. So it starts out in 1770. It's kind of going by major time frames in history. So at 1770, he's telling the story about how, this is another important point, that they buried the ashes under this oak tree, and then that trapped the witch's spirit in the oak tree so they can't get out. They're stuck in there forever. And this one is named Nathaniel, but it's Frederick March. And then he's with this woman who starts nagging him. And then he goes to the next one. It's 1861. It's the Civil War. He looks like Abraham Lincoln.
He does.
In this thing. I got him looking like, and he sounds different again. His wife is throwing stuff at him. He's trying to get away. And he says, when can you go sign up for the war? And she's like, running off to war, are you, you coward? Which is kind of funny.
I do find this whole montage really funny.
Yeah. And then, of course, the last one, like you said, that's 1904. They're showing the motorized car. This is obviously the beginning of motorized cars. And there's this old wife that's nagging him and says right on the back, just married, which I think is really funny, too. And then, boom, you come to what is modern day for this film, which I don't know what it's supposed to be, but
I think 1942.
Yeah, it's probably, it looks like they're wearing clothes of that era. But so there he is. Now he's Wallace Woolley. It's Frederick March again. You get the impression that he's being, there's a big sign that says Wallace Woolley for governor. And he's standing next to this woman, Estelle, who is played by Susan Hayward. And she's already nagging him. And you find out also her father is there. And you find out that they're getting married tomorrow. And she's just miserable looking, Susan Hayward. A little bit about Susan Hayward, besides your note about...
She came to Pittsburgh once.
The Pittsburgh note, yeah. So she is a 5-time Oscar nominee, and she did win one Best Actress Oscar for I Want to Live, which is a film I'm not familiar with.
From what I understand, she played a lot out a lot of real life stories in her films.
Oh, okay. Well, so that
would have probably been based on a true story.
Yeah, it might have been. I think I did see something like that. Susan Hayward was hit by a car at age 7 and broke her hip to the point that doctors weren't sure if she would ever walk again. However, obviously she did, luckily. She started out as a model, but she came to Hollywood when they were casting for Scarlett with Gone with the Wind, along with many, many other hopefuls. And then she was in the film The Conqueror with John Wayne. I don't know if you've heard about this film. They were shooting this film somewhere on location. I believe it was in Utah, somewhere along those lines. And they were exposed to radioactive fallout from the atomic bomb testings in the area close to filming. And it is believed that many of the actors and the crew died of cancer as a result. Susan died of a brain tumor at age 57. And it said that out of 220 cast and crew on the film, 91 of them got some form of cancer.
No, I did not. I'm not a big Western watcher, but this is horrendous.
Yeah. And John Wayne himself, another one that was in that film that died of cancer. Dick Powell as well. So, yeah, it was. There's a lot of talk that that affected them. And that's why these people all died of cancer. Of course, they also, a lot of them were drinkers and smokers. So
yeah.
It's hard to say. But I mean, it does seem like a high
it's
number.
A big coincidence either
yeah.
way.
Yeah. So, but in this film, she is playing, like you said, a shrew. She was very unpleasant. As a matter of fact, the father has to keep telling her to be pleasant.
Yes.
He says, be pleasant, at least until tomorrow after you're married. If she can just drop it after that.
Now, in modern times, we call the face she made throughout most of the movie, we shorten it to RBH.
Yes.
If you can picture it.
Yes, exactly. And so they're at this big gathering, I guess. Maybe it's the announcement of their engagement. I'm not exactly sure.
It seems like it was some sort of campaign event.
Yeah, it's something.
Because he had to give a political speech at one point.
And then you hear this, you see this thunder and lightning. Again, you get that whirly music. I think kind of symbolizes a lot of times that whirly music comes out when you're going to see Jennifer and Daniel. The lightning strikes the tree. And then you have these really cool effects of these like smoke billowing out, which I think for 1942, some of these effects are pretty impressive. And not sure who do we credit for these effects, because I think there is a visual effects person on this film, Gordon Jennings, who was a Paramount special effects expert, and he won 7 Academy Awards for his special effects. So I'm guessing he's responsible for these, but there's a lot of great visual effects in this.
Yeah, so when they come out of the tree, their souls were released because the tree was struck by lightning, and you see two pillows of smoke.
Kind of
discussing how much time the land around them has changed. It's been 270 years.
Yeah.
But it really does seem like two souls.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the smoke. And it's just, the smoke is traveling throughout the scene, which, I mean, I'm just really impressed by that, to be honest. The smoke, they do all sorts of different things
Later go into the bottles that's really impressive, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things here that I was really impressed with. So, like you said, we find out that it's the father and the daughter, the ones that had been originally burnt at the stake. This Jennifer and Daniel are the names of the characters. And they're just sort of these traveling plumes of smoke, and they're just traveling along, and they come up to the Wallace house, or the house they're in, and they're watching the modern day folk. And then I think it's really funny. They have these
young people
coming out and talking the sort of slang for the time. And Jennifer is like, what language is that, father?
We'll learn it. Yeah, the big one that Sean and I always quote is, now you're cooking on the front burner.
So then they do go into this is when they go into the bottles, which is, again, really cool. It's kind of, it almost makes me wonder about if that had some effect on the I Dream of Jeannie, you know, how the smoke goes in and out of the bottle for her.
If it inspired Bewitch, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. Those shows were out at the same time.
Because the smoke just into the ball, and there's a little sort of whistly sound, whatever, with the music. Again, he always does a great job of putting a little bit of the music in that sounds really appropriate. And they're sitting there watching the people from their bottles, and now Wallace Woolley comes out, the descendant. They realize who he is, and they're like, oh, I want to follow him. And then coincidentally, the waiter comes out and picks up the bottles and takes them and puts them right next to Wallace Woolley on the bar, and he's talking to this fellow, Dudley, his friend. Dudley is played by Robert Benchley. This fellow's kind of an interesting guy. His father was a Union soldier in the Civil War. His brother was 13 years older than him, and he was killed in the Battle of San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War. he got financial help from his brother's fiance. She was a wealthy heiress, and she sort of doted on him after the brother's death. He would go to Harvard, and he would write on their publications, and he would also be involved in acting at Harvard. He would also then work on several newspapers as a humorist, including Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. They say his work is very influential to many modern humorists. And he would come to Hollywood originally as a screenwriter, but was found to have comic acting abilities and would be given roles in film. Sadly, he became an alcoholic and would die of age 56 of cirrhosis of the liver. This is going to be a common theme.
Yes, it unfortunately is.
Yeah, common theme in this particular one. So anyhow, this fellow Dudley, he's sitting there talking to Wallace at the bar, and then here comes Estelle, and she starts, I want to go home, take me home. She's just very unpleasant. And then they go off, the witches escape from their bottles, and they call a broom. The broom comes flying over, and then they go across the sky. Now the smoke things are sitting on a broom going across the sky. This is good stuff. This is amazing stuff to me.
And they come across the Pilgrim Hotel.
The Pilgrim Hotel. Apparently, I guess the idea is that they can't resume a human form unless they burn something down.
Well, if they died by fire, I guess they have to be reborn by fire is how I interpreted it.
So they need to create a fire and have somebody die, and then they can take their body.
I think the fire just created the human form. I don't think anyone had to pass away, thank goodness.
When the father does it, though, there was a dead man. And then he took the body. So I don't know. But anyhow, so they decide to light the hotel on fire, which they do. Which, again, another pretty good special effects, having this hotel lit on fire. And as Wallace is driving Estelle home, they come across the hotel being on fire, and he jumps out. He's like, oh, we have to stop. And she's like, oh, just tell them who you are and get us through. And it's just like, whatever, Estelle. And then instead he runs up, and because he's potentially a candidate for governor, I guess they let him go past the fire line. He's allowed to go right up to the burning building.
Well, he's talking to the owner. And that's a little comedic moment because the owner is just enjoying and he's laughing. It's fully insured. I love a good flame.
He's like, oh, well, first this top floor will fall down and then into the third floor and then the second floor and then the first floor.
And he's all excited to rebuild.
And Wallace is like, yeah, what's funny about that? It's like, why are you laughing? He's excited because, oh, it's fully insured. I can rebuild. And then Wallace is like, wait, I hear some woman's voice. And the owner's like,
no one hears it.
There's nobody. Nobody hears it but Wallace, but he's certain. And so he goes rushing into the building. No firemen stop him. They're just like, oh, okay, go right ahead. Run into the burning building, no problem. And then you can hear Jennifer's voice luring him, and there's all this smoke. And there's sort of a suspenseful sounding theme here when he's walking through the smoke. I can almost see this in a horror film. I can imagine this kind of score. It reminds me of a kind of score you would have, like when somebody's coming
sneaking
to something.
Around.
Yes, exactly. And so he goes through the fog. He manages to find Jennifer, and she's very nonchalant about being in the fire. He's all worried and scared. He's like, "Whoa, we're in a fire. We need to get out." Blah blah blah.
She's more concerned with, "Am I pretty?"
Yes, she's asking him all these absurd questions, and he's like, "I don't know. I don't care. Let's get out of here." And she's like, "I don't have any clothes on," and then all this stuff. And then he winds up picking her up to carrying her somewhere. Now, did you read the thing about how
the little prank?
Yeah, Veronica Lake and Frederick March did not get along.
Yeah, they did not get along. She said he kind of treated her like dirt. So her prank, she had the cameraman rig her up with 40 pounds
of extra weight
when he had to carry her. And she just was like, big boned. Was her explanation too.
Yeah, and she had to be carried several times in this film.
Yes.
Like there were numerous times he has to pick her up and carry her.
At least three that I can think of.
Yeah, speaking of Veronica Lake, I know she and Frederick March didn't get along, but not a lot of people got along with Veronica Lake, to be honest. She was hard to get along with. She was born Constance Frances Marie Okelman. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness they switched that name. Her father died in an explosion on a ship when she was 12 years old. She was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic as a young person, and her mother and stepfather thought that acting would help her. Her role in I Wanted Wings. started her to stardom. And in one scene, she was playing a drunken person. Her hair kind of fell over her eye, and that started the peekaboo hairstyle craze. And she was very popular. People were copying the hairstyle, and she was very popular in the early 1940s. But she did have a lot of trouble with co-stars, many refusing to work with her again, including Joel McRae, who was supposed to be the lead in this film. And he said, "I will not, absolutely will not work with Veronica Lake under any circumstance." Ironically, he did wind up working with her later in his career, but that's why Frederick March was given the role. But in addition, women wearing her hairstyle while working during World War II were getting injured because their hair was getting caught in the machines, and she was asked to change her hairstyle to stop that from happening, and that wound up causing a decline in her career, and she would also become an alcoholic and die at the age of 50.
Yeah, so that was actually when I told my father that I was coming on this podcast to do this movie. That was the number one thing he said, was she had to cut her hair because women working in the factories that kept getting caught in the machines. Yep. And she was never a big star after that. She did still have several roles after that. I would say her career really declined when she left Hollywood altogether. But in her own autobiography, she tells a story about her peekaboo hair doing a little differently. She did several small extra roles before she hit it big in I Want to Wings, one of them in 40 Little Mothers, and that's when she said her hair got in her eye, and she was just annoyed with it, like, oh no, I'm ruining the shot. But Busby Berkeley, everyone loves, was like, oh, I love this hair, and that's what she said, how craze started.
Let's take her word over mine. I mean, she is the person.
I would say if you have $3 in a Kindle, get her autobiography. It's one of the most honest autobiographies I've ever read, because I feel a lot of celebrities want to make themselves look good. But she was very honest about her troubles and her drinking, too.
Well, she didn't have a very high opinion of herself at all, because she didn't think she was a good actress. She didn't think she was pretty. And unfortunately, later, after she didn't really have much of a career anymore, she was found working as a bartender or a waitress in a restaurant in New York. It was kind of sad. And then when this was found out, a lot of her fans tried to send her money, and she wouldn't accept it because she was too proud.
Yeah, that was the Martha Washington Hotel, which was not a very nice hotel. She lived there as well, so it was...
Yeah, it's kind of a sad...
She was in need of the work at that time.
My guess is that a lot of the problems with her, even like her conflict with the co-stars and her issues for out, were probably caused by her mental illness. And apparently she had a mother that was a real...
Yeah, her mother sued her at one point because she stopped giving her money, but that was because Andre was spending all of it.
Yeah, and her mother, from what I understand, was kind of pushing her into becoming a star. She was one of these stage mothers and very domineering, apparently. So, yeah, it's a shame. So he's carrying her. He takes her into this room. Again, this is such an obvious set, and it's really not even remotely realistic, unfortunately, especially when the stuff collapses. It literally looks like
just a bunch of
it does not look realistic at all. Yeah, I'm sorry. But in this room, she finds a new coat, and she puts it on, and she's trying to look at herself in the mirror, and poor Frederick March Wallace thinks that they're trapped in this room, but he's not as panicking as I would be if I thought I was trapped in a room and I was going to die. He's like, oh, we're going to die. Okay. Like, not that worried. I mean, he seems worried, but not super worried. But then eventually she shows him, oh, there's a door behind the screen, and he carries her out there too. And then he comes out, and they're taking his picture, and he's this big hero. Even Estelle seems to be happy at this exact moment. She seemed happy for a moment about him coming out and rescuing this girl, and Jennifer starts saying, oh, Wally, take me away from these people. And then Estelle isn't happy anymore.
Yeah,
and
Estelle's a little bit suspicious at that point.
Wallace throws her over Dudley, says, take her to the hospital. And then they go to the hospital to check on her. And this is when Estelle is kind of throwing a fit, indicating that she thinks he knew her before somewhere. And he keeps telling her, I don't know her.
Technically, true.
The guy keeps trying to tell her, I don't know her. I've never seen this girl before today. And she's really angry. They take off, and then you see the broom sliding across the floor, and this little music when the broom slides across the floor. You get the impression she's going to go off on the broom. Mm-hmm. It doesn't show that. And then they have the car coming up to the house. There's a nice camera pan as the car comes out to the house, I noticed. I didn't see a lot of great camera movement or cinematography tricks in this particular film, but there I did like the pan it does when the car comes up to the house. There's a cat at the front door, and the cat goes in, and Frederick March is trying to keep him out, but the cat goes in the house, and he kind of follows the cat, and who's sitting in the chair but Jennifer,
yeah,
holding the cat. Frederick March does a really good job of playing this anxiety-ridden character throughout. He doesn't know what to do, and he's all freaked out through the whole thing. He's worried. He's stressed out. He does a pretty good job of playing this, in my opinion.
And you see that in The Ancestors were all the exact same way as well.
Yeah. And so he's trying to get her away because obviously he's getting married tomorrow. He can't have a woman in his house. I mean, that doesn't look very good. And she sees the picture of yeah. Jonathan. Is it Jonathan? Well, I can't remember which ancestor we're dealing with. Yeah, Jonathan. And she's like, oh,
he would have given me a warmer reception.
Yeah. And that was kind of another clue that maybe something went on there. So he just grabbed her arm and pulls her out of the door. And she says, goodbye, Jonathan. And boom, the picture falls on the floor. Mm-hmm. And then he carries her out of the house. Again, he's carrying her in. There's a policeman standing there as he's carrying this girl out of his house. And he's like, what's going on here? And he's throwing her in this cab. He apparently has his cab on hire.
It just always seems to be outside of his house.
He knows the cab's driver's name, too. So he's always, oh, Joe, or whatever his name is. And the cab just shows up. She asks, what should I do with the coat? And he says, well, when you're done with it, send it to the police or give it to the police. Mm-hmm. And the cab turns the corner and you see the policeman still standing there. And you see this coat come flying out at him. It's really funny. And then Wallace comes around the corner and he sees the policeman with the coat. And he's like, oh, that didn't belong to her. And he's like, well, I hope it's warm in that cab. I thought that was funny. And then the cabbie, Joe, or whatever his name is, goes to ask her where she wants to go. And he realizes she's
not there.
Vanished. Vanished. So Wallace is at home. He thinks everything's fine. He puts his little picture back up. And the doorbell rings. The picture drops back down. And then again, you get the kind of a boom with the music when the picture drops down. Again, it works really nicely with the stuff that's going on the screen. And who's at the door but Dudley. Dudley's at the door checking on him. And Wallace actually confides in him and says, hey, that girl was here and blah, 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 blah.
And he was like, she was in the hospital, not a scratch on her.
Amazing. She's amazingly recovered. And now she was here. And then they begin to think that she was planted by the political opponents to cause a scandal to get him to not be elected governor. And they're convinced that this is what's happened. And he tells Dudley, I got rid of her and I'm going up to bed. And he goes up to bed and who's sitting in his bed?
Jennifer.
With his
PJs.
With his pajamas, yeah. And then he starts to accuse her about being sent by the opponents. And they're having this talk at cross purposes where he's talking about one thing and she's talking about completely something else. But he thinks she's talking about the same thing as he is. But she's talking about...
She's talking about the curse, father. Basically. Yeah.
She's talking about her father. He says, oh, your father's just specifically out to get me. And she's like, yes, but not the same. He's thinking politically, but yeah. And then at one point he says, well, you're very young. And she says, I'm older than you think. I'm older than you guess.
290 years old?
270. 70 or 90?
270 years has passed, but she's 20.
Oh, okay. So 290.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he starts to give her this lecture about love and infatuation. And
it cuts to the clock. Now, that's an interesting camera. It cuts to the clock. And you're like, oh, he's going to mansplain this.
Yes.
But then cut back to him, and he is totally infatuated.
Yes, exactly. But also, the clock zips by. Yeah. And again, the music when the clock zips by is really nice. And then suddenly it zips to 8 o'clock or something, and he's lecturing about love at first sight, and he's touching her hair. And then the housekeeper comes in. Margaret, the housekeeper, she is played by Elizabeth Patterson. She actually began her film career at age 51. She started out at age 51 in silent films, and she would appear in over 80 films within the next couple decades before turning to television. And she was best known for being Matilda Trumbull, the elderly neighbor in I Love Lucy.
I love a story about people getting a start in something later in life.
51 years old. That was when she got her start in silent films. So.
There's a lot of people that are like, oh, I didn't make it when I was 25. It's too late for me. It's never too late.
Look. Well, especially a woman. Yeah. It's nice to hear that, especially a woman.
Exactly.
Because that's even rarer. Okay, so Margaret comes in and she's, of course, shocked to see Jennifer in this bed. And Wallace seems to be completely infatuated with Jennifer. She keeps telling him things. He's paying no attention to what she's saying. Jennifer's eating like 1,000 waffles or something.
So many waffles. Yeah, they look delicious.
They did. You know what? I really wanted to have waffles after that. I was
very
like, oh,
buttery looking.
Darn it with these waffles. And then Margaret's like, there's people downstairs that need to see you. And it turns out to be Estelle and her father, who Wallace is like, Estelle who? He's completely forgotten who she is. And then he's like, oh, right. And then her father, they're happy because I guess there's some publicity over his heroics of saving her. And the father is called J.B. Masterson in this film. I have something about him as well. He is played by Robert Warwick. He was a matinee idol on stage and screen in the early days of silent film. He was almost a rival to John Barrymore in matinee status. He was trained as an opera singer, so he was able to transition into talkies in his 50s, another person that in his 50s, although he was a longtime screen and stage actor before that. And he was a favorite of Preston Sturgis, may have been brought over originally by Preston Sturgis and just kept on. But he plays the father, J.B. Masterson. And another funny thing that happens here is that Jennifer keeps knocking people over by slamming doors on them and knocking them down. Mm-hmm. She did it to Margaret, and then she does it whenever Wallace rushes as Estelle and JB out of the house. She knocks them down with the door too. And then she slides on the banister. And again, you get kind of that whoo music, you know, that goes with sliding down the banister. And she finds out that Margaret and Wallace are getting married in a couple hours. And she's not especially happy about that. She runs into the other room and you hear this flurry-like music that's really appropriate for running. And she starts talking to her father. Her father is in the fireplace. And again, the fire is going high and low depending on when he's talking. So that's another interesting effect, I thought. He tells her to make a love spell, and then they show the piano playing on its own as well. Again, there's really cool effects in this.
Yeah, that whole scene when they make the love potion, I do adore it. And she sings a cute little song. Although she was not known as a singer, I think she handled it well.
Yeah, she did all right. Yeah, she did all right as the singer. And she and Daniel both sing the love song. And her plan with this potion is to make Wallace fall in love with her and then make him miserable. And she runs back. You hear your running music. And then she slides up the banister. And you get your same, phew, up the banister. And Wallace returns. And Jennifer now has a very pretty dress on, probably designed by Edith Head.
Yes, of course.
And she's trying to give him the water. He's complaining because he had just had to leave the building because the building he was in has caught fire.
Oh, yeah.
Because the father now is going to materialize. So he needs to catch a building on fire. So they just decide to catch the building that Wallace is currently in on fire. So he again has to escape a fire building, which you'd think he'd wonder why this keeps happening. But I guess he doesn't think about it at all. And she says, quote, "No one named Wooly is able to stay away from me." And right as she says that, the picture of another Wooly falls off the wall, hits her on the head, and knocks her out.
Now that scene is when Veronica Lake played another prank on Frederick March.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you think about how the scene is framed,
he's
standing directly over her, so you don't really see her real well. So she took that opportunity to kick him in the groin, knowing that he was a total pro and he wouldn't do anything about it. And that's what ended up in the film.
It's a little more than a prank. That's a little great. A prank is kind of a funny.
She called it a prank in her book.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. But you know what? I can't give Frederick March any major passes, though, because Frederick March wasn't a great co-star either, because he was known to be a sexual harasser and a groper of his co-stars. So he's not much better, to be honest. Okay, so she's knocked out by this photo, and he's trying to revive her, so he gives her the water, which contains the potion. He gives her the water, and then when she wakes up, she's almost has these starry-eyed look on her face, and you actually get a little romantic love music here, and then Dudley is up there. Suddenly Dudley comes up, and he's trying to help, and she realizes that she's drank the potion instead of him, and she starts freaking out, of course. She doesn't know what to do, and they wind up leaving. And then this is when the hearse pulls up in front of the house, and it's filled with smoke, this hearse. And they're like, hey, why is this hearse filled with smoke? And they run in the back, and they're like, hey, where's the dead guy that was in the hearse? He's gone. And then the next thing you know, there's the father in the sheet. He's standing there with Jennifer. The father, Daniel, he is played by Cecil Kellaway. He was nominated for 2 Oscars. He's originally from South Africa, but he would begin his acting career in Australia before going to the U.S. He is a cousin of actor Edmund Gwenn, best known for Miracle on 31st Street. He played the Santa.
Oh, yeah.
That was actually a role that was offered to Cecil before him, and he turned it down because he didn't think Americans would like that kind of film.
Whoops.
He is known, however, for Harvey, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and The Postman Always Rings Twice.
I've seen 2 of the 3 of those, not the Postman one.
No, he plays the priest in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
That's one of my mom's favorite movies.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, we should have done that movie instead.
Interview my mom.
Yeah. Next time, perhaps. Okay, so the father appears in the sheet, and Jennifer tells him she drank the potion. He said, "You let me handle it. I'll take care of it. And we're going to go to the wedding."
Yeah.
So here we're at the wedding. This lady, this poor lady's trying to sing this song, this very operatic song. You can probably sing it better than me.
It's something you wanted. I love you truly, yes. Truly, dear.
Yes.
Is what it sounds like.
That is exactly what it sounds like. That is perfectly what it sounds like. It's always the same.
It's like that part.
She doesn't move forward in the song. No. She just always gets stopped and goes right back to that same. But anyhow, that's kind of a really funny part there. But Dudley's giving Wallace a drink. They go down to the wedding. Estella's at the end of the aisle. The father has to tell her to smile. She's complaining still. And so they're coming up the aisle, and then all of a sudden, you see Daniel and Jennifer at the door, and there's this humongous windstorm. And again, the music for the windstorm is really great. It sounds windstormy-like music. And they're delaying, trying to get things back in order. They think that a hurricane has suddenly occurred. And then the poor lady starts singing again. And Dudley and Wallace wind up running upstairs, and Jennifer is there with her father. And Daniel's saying, I'm telling Wallace, I want to talk to you. And he's very serious, and he's saying something about his daughter being in the house all night with him, and he should give him a horse whipping, I think he says, but instead he's going to give him this revolver. And
this is the wildest part of the whole movie.
Yeah, Frederick March is like, what? Why were you giving me the revolver? He doesn't know what's going on. He's very confused. And then he says, you're going to shoot me, and then you're going to be sent to the electric chair, and that's going to be your punishment. And so Wallace says, I'm not going to shoot you. And then Daniel says, oh, yes, you will. And it, again, the pistol spins around of its own accord. And again, there's a music. When the pistol spins around, that's really appropriate. And then, boom, the pistol shoots him, and he falls dead. And just then, Dudley comes in. And Wallace is like, it was an accident, it was an accident. And all of a sudden, Daniel gets up real quick, and he says, no, he shot me to death in cold blood, and then dies again. And then you can see the little smoke plumes coming out of the body. And Dudley says, oh, yeah, he's dead. And Jennifer, she doesn't care.
Because she knows that the body was only temporary. And anyway, she's like, smoke.
She's like, oh, it's no big deal. And he's like, oh, can you not care? Your own father. And she said, oh, that's not my father. That's just a body he picked up. And then so they go back to wedding again. And Estelle's walking down the aisle. And then
her smile looks a 5-year-old trying to smile, her gritting her teeth.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Very, very fakey, fake smile. And then Wallace comes up to the thing, but then he walks away and winds up collapsing. And then the woman starts singing again. In the meantime, Jennifer's upset with her father. She's yelling at him, and he's gone into this bottle of liquor. His little smoke has gone into this bottle of liquor, and she winds up shooting the bottle, and that makes everybody run upstairs, Wallace and Dudley, and then Estelle starts throwing a fit because he keeps running off, and the father winds up going back in the body, which is a great surprise again when Wallace and Dudley come up, and the father is drunk because he spent all this time in the bottle, and he falls off the balcony. Cecil Calloway, he does a great job of playing a drunk. He did a really convincing job of that, in my opinion.
I would say top 5 drunk performances.
Yeah, he was really good. He just looked very drunk. It looked very convincing. And he gets taken by the police. And Jennifer tells Wallace that she loves him. And he says, well, I got to go get married. So they go halfway down the stairs, and Jennifer starts screaming. And Dudley has to go back up. And Estelle, she runs down the aisle, because she wants to get married. How many times she's tried to go down the aisle now to get married, but then Wallace runs up to see. He's like, Dudley has the ring. I have to go up. And he runs upstairs, and the lady starts singing again. And then Jennifer's lying there in the thing. They think she shot herself or killed herself, and she kisses them. And as she's kissing him, Estelle's like, I've had enough of this. What's going on? And she dashes up the stairs, and she finds them kissing. And poor Wallace tries to explain, but as soon as he starts explaining, he realizes, not going to, there's no point even attempting this. And then the father starts yelling. He says, I'm going to expose you to the papers. And then the woman starts singing the line again. And he's like, shut up. It's really fun. It is a very funny scene.
It is. It's probably my favorite in the whole movie.
Is it
actually?
The wedding scene?
It's just the wildest part.
Yeah, it is. It's very chaotic. I do like the way the woman keeps singing. It's funny. So the next day, the papers show a scandal headline about Wallace. Daniel's in jail. He's freaking out. He wants to get vengeance on Jennifer and Wallace. And in the meantime, they're driving out of state, but they're driving in this fog. And Jennifer has on this cloak, this black cloak that makes her look very much like a witch.
Yeah. Oh, and it's important to note that when Daniel is drunk, he forgets all the spells which is why he's stuck in the jail cell and he can't remember how to destroy the bars.
Yeah, he was trying to melt the bars. He can't do anything. Yeah, that's true. I forgot to mention that. And all of a sudden, they're driving along. All of a sudden, the fog dissipates and they're at a house. And he's like, well, let's stay here. And they're like, well, do you have two rooms? And they're like, no, we only have one room. And he's like, well, is there a justice of peace where we can get married? And they're like, yeah, it's right here.
Convenient.
Yes, very convenient. So they wind up getting married. But then Jennifer gets worried because the lady there says, well, I hope that all your boys are like Wallace and all the girls are like you. And immediately you see her get concerned. And she wants to confess about being a witch. She wants to tell Wallace. She does tell him, and he just is like, oh, okay. Yeah, haha, good one, honey. And he doesn't believe her.
He's like, yeah, you cast a spell on me with your love.
Yeah, exactly. He's totally not convinced about this. But the next day, he goes to see Daniel, who's still in the jail, and he's like, hey, she's saying she's a witch. And Daniel's like, yeah. And then Wallace is like, oh, so she does this all the time. Mm-hmm. And he still doesn't believe it. But then she had told him that she was going to get everybody to vote for him in the election,
which is quite the task because of the scandal.
Yes,
he looked like he was gonna lose big time.
He was talking about tar and feathers. That's how bad it was. But all of a sudden, as they're in the jail, all the smoke comes in and people start chanting, we want Wooly,
we want Wooly.
Yeah. And then they show this band and they have JB, the father of Estelle, making this horrible speech about Wooly, about what's all these things are wrong with him. And then the smoke comes by and he says, and I want everybody to know that I'm voting for Wallace Wooly. And the guys are like, what? Wait, you said Wallace Wooly. He's like, oh, that's not what I meant. I meant vote for Wooly. And then everybody's chanting. And then there was a footage of the crowd. Did you see that crowd? Well, that had to have been some sort of stock footage.
I would imagine that town isn't that big.
Yeah, that looked like a literal political rally or something, like a big political convention. And I thought, oh, that has to be something that they pulled out of stock.
Yeah, a newsreel or something.
And there was another thing where they showed the ballots and the X's sliding down to his name. Which another really cool.
That was really funny.
Yeah, another really cool
effect.
Then
you hear the little whistle.
Yep, exactly. Again, with the sound. And there's the radio updates they're getting about it. Dudley and Wallace are listening to the radio updates and they're like, Wooly has 2 million such and such votes and Benzinger, none. And Wooly's like, he didn't even vote for himself. And then that's when they realize that Jennifer is a witch. And she comes into the room while they're sitting there. And Frederick March does this great scream when she comes in there. I really liked it. And then now suddenly they're afraid of her because they realize she is a witch. And Dudley's like, I'm going to leave. He says, as he's leaving, Wallace says, I'm like, can I give you a ride? He says, no, thanks. I'll just call a broom. Oh, I mean a taxi. I thought that was really funny. So then Daniel appears and he turns her into a mortal. He says he's going to take her because she told Wallace she was a witch. That's not allowed. And he's going to put her back in the tree and she's going to have to live there for however long, I don't know. And she said, no, I can fight you. I'm still a witch. And he casts a spell and she loses all of her powers and she can't do anything. So he tells her, I'm taking you back to the tree at midnight to put your spirit back in there as a punishment. And she says, well, can I say goodbye to Wallace? He says, yeah, sure, but you're going back in the tree, whatever. And so she tells Wallace, we got to get out of here. We got to get into the cab. And they get into the cab that's always waiting, Joe or whoever it is. But as they're driving along, all of a sudden you realize it's not Joe the cab driver driving, it's Daniel. And now the cab is flying, literally. It goes up in the air and it's flying through the air. Yeah, again, it's really
good stuff.
That's amazing
special. But I love the scene where I think Jennifer asks Wooly, what time it is? He looks over and it's a clock tower.
The clock tower, yeah.
Not far from like a Big Ben. He's like, oh, it's quarter to midnight. Then he realizes, double take and realizes they're in the air.
Yeah. So anyhow, I don't want to talk much more about this because this is almost the end and I don't want to ruin the end. But it's a lovely, funny film, I guess you could say. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
So it's actually one that I've only seen twice.
Same.
Sean and I watched it during slightly pandemic times mm-hmm. in 2021. That was my first viewing. And it's just one of those lighthearted romps yeah. you can throw in and put yourself yeah. in a good mood. One thing that Sean learned when we were watching it the first time around was Veronica Lake's famous hair was the inspiration for Miss Jessica Rabbit.
One of the inspirations, they yes. say. Yeah.
Definitely a movie that scared me to death as a kid. But I like it now.
Yeah. It's kind of paradoxical because it's very much a product of the 1940s. Very cut and dry, like the cinematography, the sets. It's all very 1940s. But then you have these great visual effects that I feel are not very typical 1940s. Mm-hmm. This is something above and beyond, in my opinion, at that point in time. So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly a movie that's lighthearted and enjoyable, and it's not going to put you in a depressed mood, certainly, no. I don't think. But ratings, 1 to 5, what do you give I Married a Witch?
I would probably give it a 4.
A 4?
I give 5s out sparingly.
Sparingly, though. You think you do. I never give 5s out. Yeah, but
pretty high rating coming from me. I love, like you said, it's such an original storyline yeah. for that time period to have something so whimsical. A lot of movies from the 40s were very patriotic about the war or true. Film noir. So to have something with a little bit of a supernatural flair, I appreciated that.
Yeah, and you're a supernatural fan. So this is why this is a good film for you. I will give it a 3.5 because, again, the sets, the cinematography, just very typical studio churnout film type thing. I do think the acting is good in it. I think Frederick March can sometimes be a little over the top in some of the things he does. And I see points in this film where he's a little much. I thought Veronica Lake was very good. I thought the other actors did a really good job. And I love the visual effects and I love the score. I really liked both of those things a lot. So I will give it 3.5. And I'm glad I got a chance to revisit this film. Yeah. So thank you for choosing it.
And we're tied. Yeah. 2 for 2.
2 for 2. Yeah. So, and next time, come on, maybe we'll talk about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah. Oh, I'm happy to talk about anything.
Yeah. Awesome.
I like chatting with you.
Yeah. Same. It's lovely to talk about classic films. I just wish we didn't have a time limit.
Yeah, they definitely have to put the time limit on both of us. We love to go long.
So the people that have to edit, it's not fun to edit a really long podcast. Mm. So I think we'll be wrapping up now, but I do want to thank you for being our guest.
Yay, thank you.
And for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, this is Wendy saying goodbye. Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.